quisiera antes el nombre de la directora de esta facultad, la doctora Aurora Villegas. Está con nosotros la doctora Elsa Ramírez Leiva, que inaugurará, digamos, formalmente este coloquio. Por favor, doctora, le pediría unas breves palabras.
Muy buenos días. A nombre de la doctora Gloria Villegas, directora de la Facultad de Filosofía y Letras, les damos una muy cordial bienvenida. Y también, a mí la verdad, este seminario me ha causado una gran alegría y además un gran interés, porque siento que la filosofía, como creo que también lo decía el doctor Fuller, es un marco para controlar las pulsiones humanas, diríamos, pero no para control, como decíamos, no para controlar, sino precisamente para evitar que se desborden y vayan de alguna manera o se precipiten sobre lo humano o contra lo humano del ser. Y por ello a mí me parece muy pertinente esta conjunción de disciplinas y cómo la filosofía, la gran articuladora de la ciencia, la tecnología, la democracia, la ciudadanía, yo creo que es un momento crucial para la reflexión de esta integración de las ciencias, y además también lo vemos reflejado en todos los organismos que están participando y que han conjuntado sus esfuerzos. Tenemos aquí la facultad, el posgrado de filosofía de la ciencia, el máster que se lleva también con los Países Vascos, el Instituto de Investigaciones Filosóficas, el Seminario de la Sociedad del Conocimiento y Diversidad Cultural, el Seminario de Investigación de Ética y Bioética, y desde luego el posgrado de Filosofía. Y vemos cómo estos esfuerzos se conjuntan en temas que de alguna manera son fundamentales hoy en día, con este manejo de la tecnología, de las técnicas. Como decía también Ortega y Gasset, bueno, pues el ser humano sin la técnica y sin la tecnología no hubiera llegado a lo que hemos llegado la humanidad del día de hoy. De alguna manera tenemos que evitar también sucumbir a la tecnología, someternos a ella, sino hacer el mejor uso posible. Y para eso, como decíamos, la filosofía está aquí como este marco que nos ayudará a la reflexión, y ojalá muchas otras disciplinas se integren a este trabajo tan importante. Yo les deseo de veras mucho éxito, que deriven de aquí mucho conocimiento, una serie de reflexiones que seguramente se darán a conocer, se difundirán. Y bueno, sin más, damos por abierto este seminario, lo declaramos inaugurado este martes 5 de octubre de 2010. Y les deseamos, como les decía, a nombre de la directora, muchísimo éxito. Muchas gracias, doctor Fuller.
Muchas gracias. Muy bien, bueno, vamos a comenzar toda la conferencia. Solo un anuncio, haremos una lista de asistentes para después entregarles constancias a los, sobre todo a los estudiantes que participen en todas las sesiones. Vamos a circular una hoja. Bien, esta sesión la va a conducir la doctora Adriana Murguía, que está aquí a mi izquierda. Y adelante, entonces, empezaremos la conferencia. Gracias.
Bueno, pues, sin más, damos paso a la conferencia magistral del doctor Fuller, que se titula Can Science Survive Its Democratization?
Okay, first of all, let me thank Adriana and everyone who's been responsible for inviting me to this conference, I have been at this university before. 5 years ago, I gave a talk which was on a sort of similar theme, actually, on the politics of science and technology. I can say, based on dealing with the graduate students, Adriana's graduate students yesterday, that you have a very, very remarkable infrastructure for training people to discuss these kinds of topics that we'll be discussing at this conference. And I really think that the institutional character of this stuff is very important. In other words, the ability to have a place where one can actually discuss critically the future of science in our society. In fact, in Europe, it's very difficult in terms of sustaining graduate programs that allow a large number of students for long periods of time to reflect on these issues. We're increasingly shortening the amount of time to get degrees, and students are becoming increasingly short-term oriented in terms of the kinds of topics that they have been adopting. And so these larger, broader questions, which I think are very important for the future of humanity, are not really being addressed properly or being allowed to be addressed properly in Europe at the moment, in terms of, you know, allowing the younger generation to participate. But it seems to me here in Mexico that it's thriving. And so this is a very precious thing, and you should protect it at all cost. Okay, so that's the first point. The second point is about the issue of democratization, which is a very complex issue regarding science. And I'm going to start by talking about it in the most general terms, at least in the terms that sort of appeal to me in terms of my thinking about the nature of science and knowledge more generally. Some of you may know I'm associated with this research program called Social Epistemology, which has to do with the social foundations of knowledge. I'm originally trained in history and philosophy of science, and I now teach in a sociology department and have been a professor of sociology now for over 15 years in the United Kingdom. But it's a very interdisciplinary project, and it's very much concerned about how do you institutionalize the production of knowledge. Now, in this context, science has a very specific kind of meaning. I don't use science as just a synonym for expertise or technical knowledge or something like that, okay? Science, in a way, is a very positive normative notion for me. Okay, so in other words, when one talks about science, I am talking about it in a positive way and in a normative way. And what I mean basically is two senses of universality applied to knowledge. That is to say, it is knowledge of all things for all people. Knowledge of all things for all people. That is, as it were, the ideal, the regulative ideal of science. And I think if you look at the history of science, and especially the history of philosophical interest in science, you'll see that that's really what has appealed to people. Has been that kind of idea, that in a way makes science a very distinctive form of knowledge, and in a way has always made science a kind of critical and dynamic force in society. And so let me tell you what I have in mind here. The kinds of things I have in mind at various points in the history of science and philosophy have been covered under the term, this very evil term, reductionism. Because reductionism is very closely aligned with universalism in two ways, okay? The first thing is the idea that there's a universal framework by which we can understand everything. So whether we're talking about atoms or ultimate laws of nature, right, you might say what science tells us is even though at the level of ordinary everyday observation things are very different, people are very different, nevertheless there's a fundamental underlying unity that we can ultimately get to. Okay, and so as it were, the telos of science, the motive force of science, has been about discovering that. And so tendency of science is to unify bodies of knowledge that in the past remained quite different and disparate. So there's this sense of covering all things that's very much part of what science is. But there's also the issue of science being for all people. And there's another side of reductionism that this appeals to, and that's the side of reductionism that is related to positivism, very strongly represented here. And that is the idea that there are fundamental forms of reasoning and observation that any human being, in principle, could test knowledge claims by. Right, so the idea of having observation sentences, let's say, in logical positivism, right? In other words, fundamental kinds of modes of expression whereby no matter how sophisticated and complex the theoretical concepts are, there's a point at which, at the level of observation or measurement or calculation or reasoning, that the steps involved in knowing can be made available to any reasonable person. Okay, that's part of the public testability of knowledge. And that is what science has been very much about. And the scientific method, what we call the scientific method historically, has been about bringing about that kind of form of knowing. Okay? So if you look at the scientific method in its origins in the 17th century, so let's say we look at somebody like Francis Bacon. One of the reasons why there was this drive to come up with a very distinctive method was to resolve metaphysical disputes that under normal circumstances could very easily lead to political disruption or warfare. Right, because there's a sense in which if you think about the 16th and 17th centuries, those are the great periods of the wars of religion in Europe. And so you have people who, by our lights, would indeed be seen as doing science, but the science was often very much caught up with certain kinds of religious and metaphysical beliefs that were very controversial because of their political consequences. Okay, and there was really no way, as it were, of figuring out what was true or false of what anyone was saying, unless you were committing yourself also to these religious and political views. I mean, if you think about the trial of Galileo, for example, all the different ways in which so many different things were kind of mixed up in that, you might say, right? Where there's a sense in was it wasn't just about whether Galileo could see the planets, but rather what the implications of those views were for the authority of the church as well. Well, Francis Bacon and all the people who were behind the founding of the scientific method knew that. And they basically said, we need to come up with a way of adjudicating differences in knowledge claims that do not require that we have to already agree on metaphysical beliefs, that we already have to hold the right political opinions, that we already have to hold the right religious beliefs, but rather it can be resolved at a level that is common to all rational human beings. And so this is where the emphasis on reason and observation becomes so important to science. Okay? And this is a form of public, universally available knowledge. And very much part of the scientific method has been about trying to reduce these larger theoretical claims, which have all kinds of consequences, down to that level, so that people who are not committed to the metaphysical views can still see what is empirically or rationally founded. Okay? And this is why a lot of people have thought that the scientific method could be used as a basis for political organization, right? As a kind of dispute resolution, even at that level. It was precisely because of that. The fact is, the testability side of science, right, aims at universal knowledge that all people can see for themselves. Okay? So that, in a sense, what I'm giving you here is the sense in which science, as a vehicle for democratization, it's traded very much on its universal character. The fact that we're talking about a form of knowledge that talks about all things and that is at least in principle available to all people. Okay? And so that is the and that's an ideal, I think, that is very recognizable throughout the history of science and philosophy. It is not always fully realized, of course. There are a lot of obstacles in the way, and there's certainly a lot of obstacles now. But nevertheless, I think that is the key thing, in a way, to always keep in mind what we're talking about here. Okay, and this has to do with the nature of science itself. It isn't merely a matter of science serving some other notion of democracy, but rather it's the nature of science itself that I'm talking about. Okay, so I begin with that point. Now, the second point that I want to bring up, which is something that I was discussing with Adriana's students yesterday, and is very much the topic of a book of mine from last year called The Sociology of Intellectual Life, and that has to do with the role of the university as an institution that is dedicated to some sort of democratic notion of knowledge, and what I talk about in that book as knowledge as a public good. Okay. Now, again, since I'm in the social epistemology business, right, I'm very concerned about thinking about the institutional vehicles, right, by which this particular kind of knowledge that we call science can be reproduced and promoted in society. And not any old institution will do. You need a special kind of institution. And I say this at this point because increasingly universities have to be justifying themselves in relation to other organizations rather than in their own terms. And so it becomes important to know what exactly are the university's own terms. Okay? And this is what I will talk about now. Now, the university manufactures knowledge as a public good through what I call in this book the creative destruction of social capital. Now, this is kind of my fancy sort of political economy way of talking about the integration of teaching and research, which is a more familiar classical ideal of the university that, you know, was promoted in the modern period by Wilhelm von Humboldt at the re-establishment of the University of Berlin in 1810. But let me explain how this is supposed to work. The first thing that I think needs to be mentioned is that the activity of research by itself is an elite activity. It is not an intrinsically democratic activity at all, because research is about pushing forwards the frontiers of knowledge, okay, getting it to a place where it hadn't been before. And so typically, if you look at the political economy involved in research, it involves a network of certain kinds of investigators with certain kinds of clients who put in a certain amount of money. And so there is this kind of social capital formation that takes place, which, if it works, actually enables the people involved, both the academics and the non-academics, to have a certain kind of competitive advantage. A competitive advantage maybe in the academic sphere, and a competitive advantage in the social and economic sphere. So at that stage, especially in the kind of neoliberal period in which we live, if research is just allowed to perpetuate itself without anything else checking it, that can easily become just another form of social stratification, right? Another way of separating out, the people, the haves from the have-nots, only in this case it'll be about knowledge. The knows and the no-nots, as it were, okay? Now this is where teaching comes in. Teaching is a foil to this. Teaching engages in creative destruction of research understood as social capital. Now creative destruction is a phrase that was coined by Joseph Schumpeter, who was the economist who lived in the first half of the 20th century, wrote a very famous book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. He is also the great theorist of entrepreneurship, which is where the concept of creative destruction comes from. And the idea, the reason why entrepreneurship is called creative destruction, which is a sort of paradoxical name, is that basically what Schumpeter was arguing was that the way in which capitalism revitalized itself, because there was always this tendency in capitalism for wealth to be monopolized. So how did capitalism, as it were, become a free market again, given the tendency of wealth to monopolize, which is something that we see today, of course? Well, he was concerned with that issue as well. And the idea is that entrepreneurs basically think about alternative ways of achieving the same ends that takes away the initial advantage that the dominant producer has. Okay? So what this means, now, teaching works in the similar way. Because you imagine, let's say you have a piece of research that at the moment is only known to the people who are working in a certain kind of research area. So the way in which that knowledge is typically produced is in terms of peer-reviewed journal articles, academic conferences, where, as it were, the entry costs for getting access to that knowledge is very high. Right? You already need to know a lot in order to find out what the latest thing is. Okay? Now, what teaching is designed to do is to get rid of those entry costs, right? To break down those barriers and thereby to reduce whatever initial advantage those people had who produced the knowledge, because now you're making it accessible to larger numbers of people who otherwise would not have access to it. So what you're doing, like the entrepreneur, is you're coming up with alternative, you might say, epistemically cheaper ways of getting access to the same knowledge that was gotten by rather expensive means by the original producers of the knowledge. So the original producers of the knowledge needed to have PhDs in certain subjects, they needed to have money backing them, they needed to be able to work for a long time to produce the knowledge they did. Very expensive way of doing it. But what if you come up with a cheaper way of getting access to the same thing? This is what teaching essentially does. It makes it accessible to people who were not involved in the production of the knowledge, and moreover, as a result, it makes the knowledge available to a wider number of people who may take that knowledge in quite different directions. Okay? And that's very important. So this is where the creative destruction, teaching is a creative destruction exercise. Okay? And that's why, it's at that point, it's when you move from the research to the teaching phase, when you translate the research into the teaching, that you actually manufacture knowledge as a public good. It's at that point. So it's as the research gets translated into the teaching that the public good character of knowledge takes place. And then it properly becomes science in one of the senses that I was talking about earlier. Okay. And only universities are alone in being institutions that are dedicated to this twofold process of producing knowledge and distributing it through teaching. And so the two things need to remain integrated together in a single organization. And I say this because this is a very important ground on which to defend the university. How much more time do I have, would you say?
25 minutes.
Okay. Okay. Now, you may want to ask questions about all those kinds of things. I'm going to put a few more things on the table as well. Okay. And here what I'm going to talk about is a sense of what it means to democratize science that is more connected directly to, you might say, the business of how science is embodied in people. Okay? So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to move toward a different sense of democratization of science, where science in some sense gets integrated into the way in which people live their lives. Okay, I have a book that came out now maybe a couple of months ago called Science, The Art of Living. And it's basically about how does one think of science as something that's part of one's way of living. There are some interesting precedents for thinking about this matter. And they come from the 19th century. And what I want to do is to review these, not necessarily because I want to endorse one of them. I actually think all of them have a lot of value to them, to be honest. But I think one of the advantages of going back to the 19th century is that is really the point at which the natural sciences as a whole really start to become integrated into the major forms of institutional reproduction in society, and especially higher education. Okay, and so there is this issue about exactly what it is that we want, you know, from science that we want as part of our person, right? And this is very caught up with a question that I think remains very much with us today, such as the extent to which science, in some sense, replaces or is a religion, for example, in terms of as a guide to living. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk about three people briefly, each of them representing a different national tradition in which science was integrated into society in the 19th century, and really have quite different, you might say, consequences with regard to how one personally relates to science. And the first person I will start with is William Whewell. Okay, that's Whewell. It's very strange spelling, okay. He was the master of Trinity College, Cambridge, in the middle third of the 19th century, and he's the person who coined the word scientist in English. And scientist, as you know, right, as the name of a profession, okay, a dedicated profession. Because, of course, the word science and its various cognate words have always been around, but the idea that you actually need dedicated people to pursue it for their entire lives, right, as opposed to people who do it on their spare time, right, the idea you need a scientist, right, this is Whewell's invention. And Whewell was doing this as part of a campaign, a successful campaign, to get the natural sciences integrated into the teaching at Oxford and Cambridge, which, of course, had this very strong humanistic bias and weren't allowing laboratories to be built on their campuses and things like that. Okay, so Whewell is both a theologian and a scientist. He's both of these things at once. And he is the person who basically comes up with the kind of image that I think you see very strongly represented, let's say, in Thomas Kuhn's theory of science, that scientists labor under a paradigm, right? And the paradigm is this kind of master theory, where everybody is kind of an under-laborer working to fill in the details of it, right? If you remember Kuhn's view of science. Well, Whewell originates this view and also originates the exemplar of this view, which Kuhn borrows as well, which is Newton, right? If you want to know what is, you know, the best case scenario for Kuhn's model of science would be something like Newtonian mechanics. And Whewell comes up with this idea. And what Whewell basically believed was that, in a way, science was a democratically organized society amongst itself in sort of the way that a monastic order is, right? Where everybody is equally subordinated to the same ideal. And the same ideal is not just an ideal of truth, but is a certain kind of worldview, as it were, that the science is promoting at a given moment, what we would call the paradigm. right? So the Newtonian mechanics, right, isn't just a set of equations or even a set of, you know, ways of solving problems with those equations, but it's also a certain kind of theoretical orientation to the world, which in principle can encompass everything, okay? And everybody who works in science is equally subordinated to that worldview, okay? And Newton himself talked about standing on the shoulders of giants, right, and all this, right? Everybody's kind of modest in a way, right? There's a kind of equality there. And there is still, you know, if you talk to scientists sometimes, especially when they think about their projects in terms of the long term, like, you know, what do you think is the significance of your work in the long term? Right, very often they will revert to this kind of image, where they're just each contributing a little piece of a puzzle, they're making a little step, right, and as it were, the justification for their being involved in it is in terms of the overall project. And this is basically a narrative that is a secular version of the Christian salvation story. Really. No, I mean, it's not by accident that Yule is both, you know, theologian and scientist, and he saw no problem with the... He saw the two things work hand in hand. And I think, you know, before you laugh too much, you should always check to see just how strong theologians have been in enabling science to get institutionalized at various points when there was a lot of controversy going on, largely because they would justify the pursuit of science not in terms of practical instrumental things, but in terms of some sort of long-term ultimate notion of truth that in some sense was seen as dovetailing with the religious goal. Okay, and so that's an important point. And I do think a lot of our notions of scientific progress, insofar as people still believe in such things, you know, getting at the ultimate truth, that sense of progress, very much parasitic on this kind of image that comes from William Whewell. Okay? Now there's a second image, and this is an image that I associate with Goethe, the great German humanist from the early 19th century, great cultural hero of Germany. And it's very much tied to sort of what Humboldt thought the point of doing science was. Because Humboldt himself was not thinking in terms of this kind of vision that Whewell had, okay? He was thinking more in terms of every individual as part of becoming a fully realized human being. No mere Homo sapiens, right? Beyond just the biological apeness of our being, but getting to this higher level of being a full-fledged human being, what we did was to synthesize all the relevant bodies of knowledge available, so as it were, we become a science of one. Each individual becomes a science by the way in which they integrate all the different forms of knowledge. And this was the importance. If you look at the great idealist systems of the early 19th century, you know, Hegel, Fichte, Schelling, all these guys, right? So much of their work is devoted to systematizing and organizing the sciences in some sort of unified form. Well, why are they doing that? Well, frankly, what they're doing is giving you a very idealized version of a general education curriculum. Right? This is the stuff you should study in the order in which you should study it to become a fully fledged human being so that you can embody in yourself all of the knowledge that is available. Okay? That was the ideal. So that everyone would become their own scientist. Okay? And that was the ideal that Goethe aspired to. And so when you have that kind of vision of what science is about, right, the science becomes personalized. Right, you learn all these different forms of knowledge, but the way in which you express it and you embody it in your being will be quite individualized. And if you know about the various controversies that Goethe had with the Newtonians over the nature of light and so forth, you begin to, you know, you get a sense of that, in a sense, Goethe understood the scientific method very much in these personalized terms, and there was a sense in which Newton, he felt, had completely missed that aspect, that as it were, science is for empowering the individual. It isn't just meant to be pure representation of ultimate reality, but it's also meant to be a representation that can actually empower the person who has it. Right? I mean, the representation isn't detached from the person. Okay, so that's another view, and I think that's a recognizable view as well. And I do think a lot of, you know, liberal arts, you know, in the United States and elsewhere, if you look at the way they teach science, very often still has that element to it, actually. I mean, the problem now, of course, is we tend to teach science in a very technical, specialized way, where it's just seen as kind of almost like a job thing. Now, the third and the most controversial way of thinking about science is in a way, well, this is the one that comes originally from France, and it's the one that gets associated with the, with what, you know, in the general sense, called the positivist movement. But the person who I want to speak about specifically here is Henri de Saint-Simon, who was the original patron of Auguste Comte, and wrote this very, at the time, influential pamphlet after the fall of Napoleon called the Towards a Reorganization of European Society. Okay, and here we get this kind of model of a kind of scientifically reorganized society that displaces the Catholic Church and all of its nefarious influences and actually puts the whole society in some kind of scientific footing. And of course, that's a very, very recognizable view about what science should be doing. You know, so if you think about technocracy, right, this 20th century idea of technocracy, very much derived from this sort of Saint-Simon view of the world. But the part that I want to emphasize here for consideration is the idea of collective ownership. In other words, the socialist dimension, which was very influential in Karl Marx's thinking when he was living in France for a little while. And this very, very kind of powerful and very controversial view that Saint-Simon had, which I think is kind of coming back into play now. Okay, and that is the idea that if you think about science as being knowledge of everything for all people, so we start with what I was saying, and he believed that, right? That was his view too, right? Then one of the consequences of getting a scientific understanding of how human beings work, how they are in the world, is a sense that if everybody has this knowledge, right, then it is possible to talk about collective ownership of everyone. Not only that everyone collectively owns everything, like in the sense that we collectively own property, but we collectively own each other. The human body. Okay? And you know, if you look at those of you who are kind of Marx scholars about this, and I don't want to go into any great detail because this is not what this talk's about, that in a sense, one of the things that Marx has to very carefully sort out is to distinguish his own view from this very radically reductionist view, where there's a sense in which the collective ownership of property includes the person as property. So we collectively own each other. So what this means in practice would be that if we had a scientific understanding of society that was generally agreed upon and to which we all said that, yes, that is in fact what this, you know, what is the truth about things, then it should be possible for society to say what is in the best interest for any individual to do. In that respect, the individual does not own their body, but rather everyone participates in what everyone else should be doing. Okay, and in fact, one of the things that Saint-Simon believed was that most people, the reason why they don't buy this idea, the reason why they don't believe that everyone could possibly own their body, is that they have mystified crypto-theological views, you know, about first order, you know, first person understanding, consciousness, a lot of these kind of quasi-spiritual theological notions that in fact prevent people from actually realizing that they are just as much subject to sort of scientific understanding and disposition as land is or anything else is. Okay. Now, the reason why I bring this up now is because you may know, and I believe some people in this room have even spoken about this, is that there's a very strong kind of science policy initiative across the world, actually, and very strong in the United States and in the European Union, toward what's called converging technologies for enhancing human performance. And this is an attempt on the part of science policy makers to provide incentives for people working across the natural and the social sciences to combine their forces, okay, focusing on the uses of biotechnology, nanotechnology, and information technology for purposes of governing society rationally. Okay, and that includes being able to monitor and to, you know, to actually have access to individual bodies in very direct kinds of ways, and to actually have kind of responsibility for them as well. So in other words, you could start to perhaps compel people to take certain kinds of treatments and so forth because you need them to work longer. Because we're in a financial crisis, and if people retire at age 60 or 65, right, there will be, you know, that it won't be possible to pay for their retirement. But if they work till they're 70 or 75, then we might be able to do that. And then this becomes a kind of moral imperative, understood at a collective level. I actually think there's a lot of science policy at the moment that is trying to push us to think in those kinds of directions. Okay, I won't pass judgment on this. But one of the things that I would say about it is that it is very much in the spirit of a certain understanding of democratic science, where everyone, you know, if there is knowledge of, for all people of all things, and it covers all things, then the thing among the things it covers is us. We are among the things it covers. Okay. I think Saint-Simon took that very literally, very seriously. Marx, I think, had a lot of problems with this, and this is why, in a sense, the labor theory of value is a very important kind of way of drawing a line on this matter, right? The idea that human beings add something special that isn't just reducible to the sort of the sheer material product. But I won't go on any further about that. But I do think that that's another notion of the democratic of democratic science, which, of course, to varying extents has been pursued in socialist countries, in the Soviet Union, I think perhaps more than anywhere else. And it is worth thinking about, because I do think there are other ways in which this agenda is still on the table in terms of the more recent developments in science and technology. How much more time do I have? 10 minutes. Okay. So finally, I'm going to move to another sense of the democratization of science. And it's also one that I talk about in this book, Science, the Art of Living. And this has to do with another phrase that I've coined that's gotten a lot of discussion in the United Kingdom, and it's prot science, which is short for Protestant science. Prot. I like the prot, it rhymes with trot, like Trotsky, okay? And I think that what I'm referring to here, and I think this is a very profound phenomena that's happening at the level of the politics of science, and it's basically people taking science into their own hands in the same fashion as the Protestants during the Reformation took Christianity into their own hands. Okay? Now, a very important instrument in that development was in the 16th century in Europe was the invention of the printing press, because with the printing and then the spread of literacy, which was very much promoted by the Protestant reformers, because maybe you don't know that prior to the Protestant Reformation, the way in which Catholicism typically promoted Christianity was almost by everything but reading the Bible. Right? So there were a lot of festivals, a lot of rituals, a lot of things to kind of amuse and entertain people, a lot of ways of serving their needs and so forth, you know, pastoral counseling. There was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. So the Catholic Church has always been very good at public relations, okay? But what it did not encourage you to do was actually to read the Bible, which is the authoritative scripture, the basis for the entire religion, which is, you know, in fact, if you want to talk about what is distinctive about, you know, Christianity and the Abrahamic religions, is they are the religions of the book. Right, and the role of the Bible as a privileged form of communication between God and humanity, right? That is something the Catholic Church always put on the sidelines, which is the thing that the Protestants recovered. But of course, the Catholics knew exactly what they were doing, because once actually people do get an opportunity to read the Bible for themselves, especially in their native languages, in other words, not in Latin, not in Greek, but in languages they actually spoke. Okay, they found out they were disagreeing with the interpretations that were being given by the priests or the theologians or whatever. And of course, the Protestant Reformation is all about that, right? Now, fast forward another 400 or 500 years, where we are now, and instead of the printing press, we've got the internet. Okay? And the internet now allows people to access information that in the past, again, as I was talking about earlier, in the past there would have been enormously high entry costs. So in other words, instead of having to know Greek or Latin or something like that, you would have to have a PhD to get access to certain kinds of knowledge. But now with the internet, you have all kinds of versions of the knowledge, and you have all kinds of conflicts about how to interpret the knowledge. And it's all out there for you to look at, and to talk about, and to add to, and so forth. And you get communities, networks forming that do stuff with this knowledge, and often form what in the science studies literature gets called counter-expertises. Right? So you know, this kind of... So it's alternative forms of knowledge, basically. And there are so many instances of this that we see at the moment. I mean, I think some of you may know, I'm very much involved with the evolution intelligent design controversy, which, of course, has been in the past confined largely to the United States, but is now moving to Europe, thanks to me. And so that, it's interesting, when you look at the one court case in the United States where I was a witness, if you look at those people in that school board in Pennsylvania, how did they find out about intelligent design? Which is, after all, if you actually look at the theory, is actually, you know, whether it's right or wrong, it's a sophisticated kind of theory, because it makes arguments from probability theory, right? You know, it makes arguments about the genetic code, right? I mean, it makes a lot of arguments that appear to be science and mathematics based. So how did these people from a school board in the middle of nowhere even hear about intelligent design? The internet. Okay, and so when they were under oath and the lawyers asked, "You think this is a viable alternative to Darwin's theory of evolution, which the scientific establishment has been pursuing for whatever hundreds of years. So where did you find out about this alternative form of knowledge called intelligent design?" I said, "The internet. And I saw a lot of good websites, and I watched a few videos, and, you know, I emailed a few of the people who were experts in the area, and I started getting a sense that this may, in fact, be an alternative way of understanding the origins of life." Now, you see, this kind of stuff is happening all the time now. I mean, in this case, it went to court, but that is just the tip of the iceberg, you might say. I mean, if you look at other things, like, for example, the continued rise and spread of alternative and complementary medicine, right? Alternative and complementary medicine, even though the medical establishments of most countries of the world are repeatedly condemning it, nevertheless, the popularity doesn't die. It increases. Alternative, you know, controversies sprout up everywhere. They don't get stopped. They don't get quelled. And if you look at where people are getting their information, the internet, again, okay, very important. Even something like Wikipedia, the whole idea of Wikipedia, even though, in a way, it makes a big point of saying we're citing sources and so forth, experts can never represent themselves in their expertise. In other words, you can't have Richard Dawkins saying, "I'm Richard Dawkins, and you're wrong about what you say about me." You can't do that in Wikipedia. Wikipedia does not respect expertise in that very fundamental sense. Okay? And of course, as you know, one of the founders of Wikipedia, in fact, believes that Wikipedia is this complete nightmare as a result, and that we need to reinvent expertise on the internet. Now, you see, all of these developments that are taking place are part of what I call prot science, Protestant science. Okay? And it has a lot of the same characteristics of the original Protestant Reformation. And this is where I really think, you know, for those of you who have a kind of historical sensibility about these matters, that you should go back and look at what was going on in the 16th and 17th centuries, and especially the way in which the different parties sort of represented or misrepresented each other. So, for example, it was very common during the Reformation for Catholic theologians and priests to call the Protestants atheists. Okay? And in fact, as you may know, the history of the word atheism, right, until the 19th century, was pretty much a kind of swear word. It was a word that you used against your opponent. It wasn't a word that you yourself would apply to yourself, right? But an atheist was basically anyone who was dissenting from the established church. Because by calling the person atheist, you were denying them that they actually could have their own access to God. They could have their own access to Scripture. You were denying that. Okay. Now, Protestantism, I think, effectively overcame this. So nobody thinks of Protestants as atheists today. Okay. But I do think this is kind of the challenge that, in a way, faces the Protestant science, the prot science today. And if you deal with these people, the thing that's really striking about them, whether we're talking about the complementary medicine people or the intelligent design people or the people who live and die by Wikipedia, is these people are not idiots. Okay? They are not, I think it's very easy to somehow imagine that these are some kind of anti-science, backward cavemen or something, right? They are not that at all. And very often these people are actually working in the sciences themselves, and what they do not accept are basically the larger covering explanatory theories that the scientific establishment tends to prefer to account for things. So in other words, you might have somebody, let's say, believing in intelligent design theory who's working as a geneticist, does perfectly competent genetics. In fact, we have one guy in Britain who's very active as an intelligent design proponent who got knighted for his work on medical genetics. But he doesn't believe in the theory of evolution. Right? And the point is, you don't need to, right? There's a sense in which to do the work of genetics in that specialized sense, to do that, that kind of knowledge, you don't actually have to commit yourself to a higher order theory. The higher order theory is needed if you want to unify the different disciplines under a certain kind of common rubric. And this is where all of these Protestant signs descend. They descend at that level of covering explanations. So they're not trying to deny the technical expertise that goes along with the science. In fact, many of them are practitioners of it. But what they deny is kind of, you might say, the more philosophically interesting parts of science. Right? The more theoretical aspects, the more explanatory aspects of the science. Because they see, I think, quite clearly that those aspects of the science, where science functions as a kind of explanation, covering explanation for things, is where science actually has impact in culture at large, where science really matters, you might say, as an ideological formation, is there. It's not in terms of what people are actually doing in a genetics lab, or whether they handle their test tubes right, or something like that. There it doesn't matter. What matters is the larger explanations, and there you're getting increasing amount of dissent. Okay, and this is actually quite in the spirit of the Protestant Reformation. And the other aspect of it goes back then to this point I mentioned earlier about the need to integrate science in one's life. Because one of the reasons why I think a lot of these Protestant science people are resistant to a lot of the larger explanatory principles of establishment science is that they basically do not like the view of the world that is being promoted in those explanations, either implicitly or explicitly. And so in this respect, let's say, somebody like Richard Dawkins is very useful. Because there's a sense in which Richard Dawkins, in a way, makes it kind of very clear what are the worldview implications of accepting Darwinism. Okay? That, in other words, yes, Darwinism is a theory, right? It's an explanatory theory, but if you actually believe the theory, if you actually really think it's true, you do have to think about your world differently. Right? And he is exactly right about that point. And this is where the dissent comes in. You see, is that people don't want to get to that. They don't want to agree with him on that. They don't want to. They say, well, in that case, we have to challenge the worldview. But the challenge to worldview is not necessarily to challenge all the technical expertise of science. It is not necessarily to challenge all the things on a day-to-day level that works about science. I think that's a really important point to establish here. But what you're doing is you're attacking the ideological component of science, where science, as it were, is supposed to be knowledge for all people in society. In which case, then, it is very important that everyone actually is able to relate to that body of knowledge. So there is a real issue here, I think. And there are two ways one can go on this. And this, again, reflects, I think, the history of Christianity as well. Because there's always been people in the history of Christianity who believe that after the Protestant Reformation, Christianity has to reorganize itself and reunify. Right? In other words, we need, as it were, a kind of genuinely Catholic Church. Right, and of course there has been a lot of ecumenical movements within Christianity have been periodically strong. In other words, we have to in some way incorporate all of this dissent, into some sort of higher order view of science that can really serve as a kind of normative model for how we should live, etc. But then, of course, there are others who say the dissent is irreconcilable, and that you have to live with multiple Christianities, and then you would have to live with multiple sciences. Right? And that you just have to respect the fact that just as Catholics have to respect the fact, and vice versa, that both Catholics and Protestants are Christians, in some sense, even if they hold radically different views about how they explain certain kinds of important religious principles, okay, that maybe we might have to end up saying something about science along those lines. That there are some irreconcilable differences there as well. And that there, we shouldn't be pretending to think that there can be a royal society or National Academy of Sciences that operates like Vatican. Okay? That is not no longer a viable model. Now, if that is the case, then can we still talk about science as universal? Right? Or then does science, you know, when it becomes plural in that sense, does it lose its universality altogether? And the way I would suggest we think about this is to think about what is the status of Christianity today? The fact that we have all these multiple denominations of Christianity around, does that mean that Christianity no longer really exists? Or does it mean that there are just these different forms of Christianity that coexist? I think this is the way in which we will have to start addressing the normative question of science in the future as well. And I'll stop there and open it to questions. Thank you. We've got the time. Why not? Just take each person as they ask.
Okay. So, abrimos a preguntas.
I'll take each question as you raise them. Yeah.
Is are the new technologies, the internet, a danger for the university to survive?
Excellent question. No, it's a good question.
Because I see that the both things act similar. In the institution, as you say, there are constructive destruction,
creative destruction. Yeah.
And in the internet, that happens in the same way. On the other side, there's a more general view, a more general way of doing this in the internet, because there's the sense of a global community. That's the side of the universal. And in the other side is the sense of the participation of the individual, of each individual
yes.
in this network. So it's exactly the same function of the university, but in a more general sense, I think. Is that a challenge for the institution to survive?
Okay, this is a very good question. There are two ways I'm going to answer it in two ways, because I think there are two different angles on this. The first angle, which has to just do with the technological side of the internet, you might say. As you know, universities have very mixed attitudes toward the internet, and especially things produced on the internet that weren't already produced somewhere else. And I do think that one way in which the internet in a way is challenging the authority of the university, insofar as the way in which it produces knowledge collectively isn't quite formally recognized by the university as such. And what I worry about in this regard is you're getting a situation that is comparable to what happened in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, where you had a lot of academics, and this is what Whewell was responding to, actually, where, let's say, for the first 50 years of the Industrial Revolution in England, you had a lot of academics who thought that if knowledge was being produced in a mechanics workshop or in a factory, right, if it was done in those kinds of industrial settings, that it wasn't really proper knowledge, right, because it wasn't cast in Latin and Greek, it wasn't related to other prior theoretical book-based knowledge, it was rather just knowledge that was practically created. And so it didn't have any status. And Whewell's point was that knowledge has to be incorporated in the university. You can't leave the natural sciences and engineering outside the university. They have to be brought in. And I think we're sort of in a similar kind of problem at the moment with a lot of this sort of digital stuff, that universities still have very mixed feelings about it. They don't quite take it seriously enough as knowledge. But I think that will be remedied over time, and I think that will be remedied largely through the younger generation. I think a generational shift, I think, will make a big difference there. In fact, I actually think that that's a way in which students can actually help the university to grow, is by, in a way, being quite proactive in archiving and engaging in what's called digital curation. You know, so you got all this stuff in the internet. How do you come up with standards of what's good and bad and what's worth preserving? I think students, especially because they spend so much time in the internet, are actually in quite a good position and have developed, you know, maybe rules of thumb that in a sense could be integrated into sort of more normal forms of the way in which we evaluate knowledge. I mean, at least I would see that as a positive step. The other side of your question has to do with the global character of the internet and whether that, you know, is like what the university is up to. It's a little different. See, one thing about the university, because the university is an institution, which the internet is not really an institution, right? I mean, but the university is, that means it has a sense, of corporate identity of what it should be doing, right? And one of the things, because the university has been devoted to manufacturing knowledge as a public good, there's always been a concern that the universities be universal. There's always been a concern. Whether it's been realized, of course not. Universities remained very elite institutions until the middle to the late 20th century. But nevertheless, universities have been typically institutions that made a point of trying to incorporate members from disadvantaged parts of society who were talented in various ways that the university respected. So if you were poor, it would be a way, perhaps, to get in and to be raised. Now, the internet really has nothing like that. In other words, the internet has nothing comparable to what in the United States is called affirmative action. Right? Because, see, affirmative action, I think, is a very important university-style principle because it presupposes a notion of the whole, of the universe. And then it wonders, do we have that entire universe represented within our borders? So we have all these people in the society, but are they all represented in the university? There is no place really to ask that question of the internet. The internet is pretty much self-selecting, self-organizing. It is biased in all kinds of ways, so that even though there are billions of people on it, there is a very strong skew as to the kinds of people who are on it, the kinds of people who are on it a lot, and who have a lot of impact on it. And I think a good way to look at this is Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia has 75,000 regular contributors, but 3 or 4 million people have at some point contributed to it. And of course, then a much larger number of people access it on a daily basis. So it's what, number 6 or 7 of all consulted sites on the internet. But you see, if you look at the if you look at those numbers carefully, that indicates a really high level of stratification. Okay, and I think the internet. So in other words, the sheer size and unboundedness of the internet does not necessarily mean that it is a place of democratic representation. I think that's very important, right? And a lot has to do with the fact that the internet is not formally governed as a corporate entity. So there is no sense of what corporate responsibility means on the internet. And so the whole idea that you are somehow responsible for making all knowledge available to all people, that is a university thing. That is not an internet thing. Okay, so I do think that there is that issue, and I do think that it's, you know, it may be that those biases and those asymmetries that currently exist in terms of people who overpopulate the internet, maybe that will be redressed over time. It may be, maybe through market mechanism, I don't know what exactly, but I don't see it happening so naturally. I can see the same biases continuing for a long time. So I do think there's a difference there. This is where, by the way, another reason why universities actually should take a more active interest in the internet, perhaps as potential governors of it. Yes?
When you're just saying, I think it's going to happen, thinking of open access. Now, all the rules and regulations that are coming out with open access and printing knowledge for free on the internet is going to change the whole structure of universities, of let's say, evaluating scientists and how do we get resources, it's going to change the whole structure.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, and I do think here we've got a case where forces of democratization and more general market forces are kind of interacting with each other in sort of complicated ways, actually. Because sometimes market forces, you know, where you, as it were, you get rid of the monopoly that had been on knowledge by making it easily available in all kinds of ways. That can be understood as a democratic process, but equally as a market process, right? That it can be understood both ways, and a lot depends on what happens. Who's able to benefit from this the most, right? It's one thing to say there's open access, but not everyone can equally take advantage of the situation. And that's the difference between the market and democracy, right? Because the market gives you the open access, but whether you're in a position to take advantage of that access is a question of democracy. Was it
Fernando?
Somebody? Yeah, it was you, right?
Yeah.
You are right in the sense that knowledge is a public good, jointly with health or rights warrant of safety for someone. And are you conscious that your argument is very, very similar in structure to the argument of the Rifle Association in the United States against the possible laws banning the use of guns by the citizen, because the Rifle Association says that because safety is a public good, every citizen has the right to use the guns to protect himself.
I think that would work well with knowledge, though. It might not work well with guns, but it might work well with knowledge.
It's very usual in every kind of public goods. For example, in environmental question, and many neoliberal solution proposed to make responsible each individual or each citizen for the care of the environment of this property or health property or something like that. It seemed to me that the question of how to protect public goods in a democratic way is very different to propose that is a liberal solution, in order that each individual is responsible for the public good.
Yeah, I mean,
I consider your proposal is critical only in appearance. In fact, it's a neoliberal solution to the public good problems.
Well, I wish it would. Neoliberals don't embrace it. I mean, in fact, I think what's happening now is that knowledge is just losing its status as a public good. I mean, what's basically happening is research is increasingly turning into intellectual property of various sorts, because there's no longer a demand that it actually be taught and be put into a kind of public forum. Right? The more the teaching and research get separated from each other, the more the public good character of knowledge is being threatened. And so as universities increase, you know, maybe it's happening here, it's certainly happening across Europe and the United States, that increasingly people are being hired not to do both teaching and research, but just to do one or the other. Okay, each with their own client base, as it were. And there is no general kind of public good being served in terms of translating research into teaching. And that's what I'm talking about is under threat. And that's that breaking apart of teaching and research is a product of neoliberalization, because basically what it reflects is the idea that research, the market for research and the market for teaching are different. They're segmented markets. You deal with them separately. Teaching gets interpreted basically as providing credentials for people to get jobs. So teaching is about sending a market signal as to who you should employ. That's what education turns out to be in neoliberalism. And so there is no, you know, and research is basically this way of wealth creation. It's a form of wealth creation for the people who can afford to make the initial capital investment. And that's kind of where we're going at the moment, I think. So it's splitting apart the teaching and research function, which to me breaks apart the idea of knowledge as a public good. But I do think you do. What I do believe is you need a political economy style argument for justifying knowledge as a public good, and that's why I'm willing to talk the language of political economy. Because I don't think you can justify it just in pure spiritual terms. There's no market for spirituality. So you need a political economy explanation that actually ends up giving you a public good and conception of knowledge.
Okay. Are you proposing, for example, in the case of the health system problem, a Wikipedia solution also?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. I see. Oh, okay. No. All right.
In politics, are you proposing a kind of Wikipedia solution to safety politics?
I do think I see where you're coming from now. Yes, because there is this Protestant science thing. This is what you're getting at. The stuff I talked about toward the end, right? The idea of people taking science into their own hands. And so I guess that's the context in which I should be understanding your remarks. So there are two things going on at the moment that have to do with democratization. One of them is what I've been very active in, which is to promote the integrity of the university as this kind of classical, universalizing, public good institution. But equally it's true that one of the things that's going on in society now, partly as a result of the internet and so forth, is you're getting a kind of Protestantization of knowledge, where in a sense everybody still kind of believes in science, but they don't believe in experts. Right? And so, you know, what this Protestant science is about is not anti-science, but it's anti-expertise. And this is where you end up with the Wikipedia solutions, right? In a sense, you know, the scientists say X, but I'm going to look for a second, third, fourth, fifth opinion, and then I'm going to decide for myself. And I guess you think this is kind of neoliberal when people, right, this is what you're talking about. Yes, and I think we're kind of in a way, that's why I ended my talk with this kind of difficult situation of whether we're going to end up having a situation where we're going to have to talk about multiple sciences as a result of people, you know, coming up with their own judgments about what sort of science to believe. I mean, I do think that's a real issue here. But I do think that there is nothing wrong in principle with people wanting to, as it were, decide on scientific principles that they can live with, you know, and integrate science in their lives, rather than treating science as kind of an authority that exists externally to them. Because I do think that's the problem with expertise, that the kind of politics that expertise breeds is very authoritarian when it gets right down to it. And that's a very difficult thing to kind of get around. And I take that the Protestant science idea is really trying to break that down very directly by taking advantage of alternative sources of knowledge. And I guess I'm open-minded on that point. I'm open-minded. I'm not against this. But I do think we still need to be pursuing this business of the university's integrity. So I want to move on both fronts at once, you might say.
Well, yeah, I agree that expertise is authoritarian. The ultra-liberal option is also risky because the ultra-liberal option is also risky because that could lead groups of people to be not only influenced but brainwashed by market forces or political forces or religious forces, yeah. which I think is something that has also happened with Protestant religions. I think that some Protestant religions are just brainwashing people about some, I mean, with political ends, like with trying to build up the political power of these religious leaders or trying to build up their economic power. I really don't know if there is a real solution somehow to this other problem, because ultra-pluralism options, I think, tend to be on this weak or could be amenable to this problem with political and economic powers.
okay, well, this is one reason why I do promote the university, because I think it's in the university where you can develop the kind of critical skills. So yes, there are all these different competing versions of science, ideology, religion out there. But one of the points of going to a university is actually being able to ask the right questions of these things. So that even if there's a lot of propaganda out there, and I really think there's a sense in which you cannot stop that.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, what the university does is it immunizes you, you might say. Right? It immunizes you against the worst effects of it by teaching you, you know, kind of what are the shortcomings of these views, what kinds of questions do you need to ask of these views before you make a judgment. So in other words, in a sense, I want to have both, right? In other words, I want to allow that kind of openness, but the university still needs to be there as a strong agent to teach people how to be critical, so they have the immunity, the intellectual immunity, so they're not just brainwashed, as you say. Right? So you need both operating together. What you don't need is a kind of free market of ideas and a weak university.
Yeah.
That's what you don't need. But if you've got the two in tension with each other, then that might be very interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think the thing is, sure, people are always going to be trying to brainwash you, but if you have the intellectual capability, you can push back. You can ask the questions. You can demystify them. Okay? But you need to have the equipment to do so. You need to have the intellectual equipment to do so. And that's what universities are for. So that's kind of what... So I'm a believer in the productive value of conflict. Okay? I really do. And in a sense, this is where... We were having a little discussion yesterday about Thomas Kuhn's views of science. And Kuhn is the ultimate in conflict avoidance, right? In a sense that all of science is pursued under a paradigm where everybody holds the same views for long periods of time. And the reason why he held that view in part was because before that, in the 17th century, we had wars of religion all the time, where you could never resolve any kinds of disputes with regard to knowledge without killing each other. Okay? Well, my view is that maybe we should be willing to live with a little more tension, a little more conflict than we're currently living with by deferring to experts so much. And let's see if we can get to a position where we're not having war, but where we can have a lot of people making a lot of strong claims publicly, but yet there are people who are intellectually well-trained and are able to fight back. And I think that will improve the level of discourse and the level of policy generally. And I think this would be a test of the maturity, our maturity as a democracy, is our ability to put up with that kind of conflict. That's my view. Yes, sir?
I wanted to touch on that just because you raised the issue of conflict.
No, he's giving you the microphone.
I wonder if looking at it in a conflict model isn't also, in a way, accepting a Darwinian ideology of ideas and technology being exchanged. Even this term creative destruction, you started with Schumpeter. I was just at a conference on evolutionary economics in Russia, and they used Schumpeter as one of the founders of this field. But to use teaching as a type of destruction seems to be a challenging notion. And their words on the economy and change and development were dehumanized. This is a term that you use in your book, The New Sociological Imagination. And in part, it's because they're trying to find a positive idea of a science of creativity.
Yeah.
But they haven't found that. They tried it in this Triz and whatnot. But that got me thinking, again, is what you said as well about eugenics and this sort of pressure to make science fit to the society, whoever's governing at that time. I like the idea of prot science. It seems to be a UK or I don't want to say American thing, but in contrast to, say, for example, a ecumenical science, which might be more Catholic in a sense, if that dialogue could be opened up, in a sense that the word Catholic does have a kind of ecumenical meaning. But if we look at this, the unit of study, like, for example, Michael Burraway, the new president of the ISA, is pushing civil society as the measure for how we should promote this. I mean, you could even use eugenics in connection with Burraway, but I don't think he goes there. But won't altruism save us in this type of ideology? Whatever civil society wants, we can use eugenics and we can adapt the technology and with whatever kind of political system we can shift to do that. But sort of my last question is what you started with, this
you said science, in your definition, is positive and normative. How does this idea of a reflexive science come in? Or what role does reflexivity have, in your view, in social science, especially in view of this dehumanizing factor that you see happening as a result of the scientific moment today?
Okay, well, look, a lot of things here. Let me start with the last point about reflexivity and kind of work my way back, because the issue I want to pick up from what you said is the issue of creativity. I want to pick that up too. The way I see the reflexivity thing operating. Remember one of the things I talked about here. I mentioned Saint-Simon and this kind of idea that he had, that science involves, you know, everyone owning everything, including other people. Okay. Now that's, in a sense, you know, thinking about science in a very system level term, you might say, and applying it reflexively. So science encompasses all the people who believe in the science, so they become the stuff of science. Okay. So, you know, those of you who follow that kind of systems theory view, Saint-Simon had something of that. But the Protestant science stuff is reflexivity. I think it's reflexive in a more down-to-earth sense, namely trying to come up with science you can live with, right? I mean, remember, the kinds of objections that, let's say, intelligent design theory people have to Darwinism, or let's say what alternative medicine people have toward orthodox allopathic medicine, is the image of the human being that is implied by the science. They cannot live with that image. Right? And so insofar as that image is part of the explanatory structure of the science, that is going to be grounds for rejection. Because, as it were, what the theory says about them, they can't live with. Right? They need a science they can live with in that very fundamental sense. In other words, the explanations that I make of my own actions have to be able to empower me. I cannot have explanations of my own actions that basically say I can't do anything, or that I'm going to be extinct before I know it. Or, you know, I mean, really. I mean, and I think that's where the reflexivity matters. And it's very much the strength of, I think, the Protestant science movement, right, is in that kind of idea. A science you can live with. You know, so that when somebody like Richard Dawkins says, and not just him, of course, all kinds of people say this, that, well, you know, you can't pick the science you want. You know, science says awful things. And I said, well, that's not quite a good enough answer given science's aspirations. Right? The universalist aspiration of science means that you have to be able to understand in a very full-bodied way if you really want people to take that theory seriously. Right? Because if all that science is some kind of, you know, account of reality that you bring out only on certain specialized occasions when people ask you a question, like, what is the proper theory of the origin of life? And you say, well, neo-Darwinism, of course, but then you forget about it the rest of the time. Right? I mean, maybe that's the way in which some people want us to think about science, but it seems to me that is not in the full spirit of what science is supposed to be as this universal form of knowledge. Because once it is that form of knowledge, then it has more, it has stronger existential implications for the person holding it. And I think that's the reflexive element that's quite important here, is that.
Does the reflexivity somehow limit science then? Does it somehow make it, does it expose the boundaries?
Well, you know, remember I mentioned Goethe as one of the models of how you embody science. And one of Goethe's views, which I think comes out also in the German Idealists, is that the different branches of knowledge, the different sciences that you incorporate into your one being, so you study all these different fields, but then you integrate them in yourself, right? Each of them, as it were, opens you up to something different. Right? And then, as a whole, you're able to face the world in an open way, with all full of possibilities. I mean, at least that's the idea, right? That's the idea. But I want to get back just briefly to the creative destruction thing. Because I do think that that's a very interesting point. Because you picked up this idea that I see teaching as a sort of destruction, right? Which is right. That in a sense, you know, teaching destroys the sort of advantage that research can easily create for those who produce it initially, right? And I think the way you need to see this is that teaching in a way is liberating the knowledge, right? It destroys, as it were, the expert packaging and makes the knowledge more available to more people, right? So in other words, there's more to the knowledge than just the particular way in which it is packaged linguistically or technologically to begin with. That there are always alternative forms of embodiment for the knowledge, right? And in a way, teaching opens that possibility. And it seems to me that then allows for creativity, because then you get different people who have different backgrounds being able to use the knowledge for their own ends. So there's an opening that takes place through that destruction.
Hello, where is the question?
I didn't see the hand. Very, very quickly went up.
Somebody
had a little finger up at one point.
No hay más preguntas.